I welcome you to another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word, and invite you to join me in the book of Ecclesiastes. We started this book last Friday. Didn't get very far because I did a big introduction to it, but I think it would be helpful if we start at the very beginning of the text again in this fresh week. Now keep in mind, I am of the opinion that it was not King Solomon who wrote this book. He certainly is qualified to match some of the things that are eternal internal evidence about the author inside the book. But his name is not attached to it anywhere in the text itself. I think it's more likely that the other person who matches the eternal internal evidence of this book, that is, someone who was a son of David, a king in Jerusalem, he is wise, he is wealthy. This is much more likely to be King Hezekiah in my mind. You remember that King Hezekiah had a life crisis. He was told when he was still relatively young that he was going to die. It didn't matter that he'd done so many good things. He was facing a physical illness that was going to kill him. And so after the prophet Isaiah told him that, he turned his head to the wall and began to pray to God and begged God for more time. And before Isaiah was even out of Hezekiah's palace, God granted that request and gave him 15 more years. Now, Hezekiah was happy about that, excited over it, but I think as the time began to tick off on those 15 years, he began to realize, hey, I've only got 15 more years. And so he has this crisis of, I am facing death no matter what I do. And how do you grapple with that? And so I believe he is the one who wrote this book as a journal of his life crisis. And the conclusion that he comes to at the end of the book is what we need to keep in our minds every single time we are reading from the text itself. Because there will be points at which he will be very down. He will be depressed. He will be exasperated. But we need to know he eventually gets to a conclusion that we should all come to. And that is, everyone must fear God and keep his commandments. That is, do what God says. And the reason is because everyone has to answer to God for what they do with this life. So I believe that this book is an excellent book for helping us to make the most of life and to realize everyone grapples with this idea of facing their own mortality. And it would be best if you don't descend into the hedonism and depression that one could be tempted to fall into whenever you come to this realization, I'm going to die and there's nothing I can do about it. So with all that introduction, let's address the book itself again from the very first verse. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1. The words of the preacher, and that actually is coming into English, I think through the Latin and through the Greek, which is also where we get our title for this book. Ecclesiastes has to do with somebody that is in the assembly of believers. Ecclesia is the Greek name for a church. And somebody that is a preacher in a church is the ecclesiastes. He is the person who does the assembling together and addressing that assembly. Now, I am of the opinion, though, that we should pay more attention to an alternate translation of this word. In Hebrew, it's Koholet, and it has to do with the gathering together, the collecting of things. And we know that Solomon and Hezekiah after him both collected wisdom. And they both had assemblies at which they collected people together in the name of God. Solomon, when he dedicated the temple in the first place, and then a couple of centuries later, Hezekiah, when he rededicated that same temple. So I believe that instead of preacher, we should be using the word collector. And that's what I'm going to do from here on out, rather than use what's in the English Standard Text. So just be prepared for that. So again, the title of the book is The Words of the Collector, the Son of David, King in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the collector. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And I warned you Friday that I don't think this is a word that we should think of as useless. It can mean that. But it also has this sense of being like a breath, being like a mist. It's something that we cannot grab hold of. We can't shape it. We can't save it. And so what I think Hezekiah is trying to bring out here is everything is out of our control. We cannot mold it or save it for our own benefit. Life is just what we have for the moment. Now, verse 3. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. So what does a person gain by doing all the hard work in life? They're still going to die. And we see this happen to generation after generation after generation. The earth is still here after all this multitude of generations that have taken place since Adam and Eve. But all the individual people are either gone or they're going or they will go into death. Verse 5, the sun rises and the sun goes down, and then it hastens to the place where it rises. So the earth's workings are cyclical. The sun gets up in the morning and crosses the sky and goes down. That's a day. And you may remember that Hezekiah's sign that he was given that he would get more time was that the shadow of the sun clock went backwards a little bit. But in reality, every single day since that miracle moment, Hezekiah has watched day after day after day tick off of his 15 years. And there's nothing that he can do about that because that's the way it works. Verse 6, the wind blows to the south, goes around to the north, around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. So the wind is not always from the same direction. Now, we know about the cyclonic nature of weather patterns and things because we get to see satellite maps every day related to the weather. Well, they understood it just from the pragmatics. Sometimes the wind would be out of the north, sometimes it would be out of the south, but it's going to shift around all over the place because that's just the way it works. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. So the ocean just doesn't fill up with all the water in the world. We know that it evaporates and then it gets up into the clouds and the cloud patterns move. The water condenses, precipitates, falls on the high places and all the other places and makes streams and brooks, and eventually it flows back to the ocean again. That's just the way the cycle works. These guys understood the water keeps rotating through the streams. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. So everything is tiresome because it just keeps getting repeated. And we can look at all the stuff in the world, and our eye never shuts off because it's completely full. We can listen to all the things that we can listen to in our life, and our ears don't just shut down saying, oh, I'm full, I can't have any more. Because life is just ongoing. And we soak up as much of it as we can, and then we're done. Verse number 9, what has been is what will be. What has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Now there may be new versions, maybe more high-tech versions of things that have been in the past. But the basic precepts just keep getting repeated over and over and over again. Because we're caught in this cycle in this fallen world. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? Well, it's been already in the ages before us. And from time to time, we find out. Through archaeology, that peoples of the past have had things that we're just now rediscovering. For example, I used this example last week. There are some places where the Roman Empire existed that they had central forced air heating that was not rediscovered until last century as to how to do that sort of stuff. And we've had toilet systems that would wash away the excrement. In ancient times, they actually had toilet systems that would do that. But then, with the collapse of the Roman Empire, a lot of that stuff was forgotten. And then we have to rediscover those sort of principles. We might not do it the exact same way they did it, but it's the basic principle all over again. I'm always amazed by pointing out to people, you know, that some of the massive blocks that were put into ancient buildings, and I'm not thinking about the pyramid, I'm actually thinking about Herod's reconstruction of the Jewish temple. Some of those blocks were hundreds of tons, and we're not exactly sure what sort of mechanisms they used in order to put them in place. They had some sort of engineering knowledge that we don't know about to this very day. We've had to not use muscle power. We've had to put steam and fossil fuel power engines to work in order to move those sorts of weights. One of these days, we'll figure out how they did it by animal and human muscle power. But it won't be new. It'll be ancient. So that's his point, is that just because you and I don't remember it doesn't mean it wasn't something from the past. Verse number 10 again. Is there a thing of which it said, see, this is new? Well, it's already been in the ages before us. There's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. So if Jesus doesn't come back within our generation or the generation after that, eventually it's likely that Western civilization will collapse. That's just the way it happens. Civilizations collapse over time and get forgotten, and their technology falls by the wayside. And if that were to happen, then the people who follow us later will be surprised at some of the things they have to rediscover that were lost in the collapse. That's just the reality. Now, verse 12. After that little introduction, we get to the explanation about the book itself. Verse 12. I, the collector, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. So again, because of some of the internal evidence here, it can only be Solomon or Hezekiah. that wrote this book, and I am heavily in favor of Hezekiah. Verse 13, I applied my heart, and when the Jewish people talk about heart, they're meaning the thinking process, the choice process. So I applied my heart, my thinking process, to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. So his goal was to figure out, using wisdom, how things work, how things fit together, how to relate to them. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of men to be busy with. I have seen everything that's done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. Now, when he says it's an unhappy business, some places, some translations will have the idea it's an evil business. It's not a moral judgment here. It's talking about the feel of it. When Adam and Eve fell into sin, they brought the curse upon this earth. And as Romans chapter 8 talks about, everything, both the earth itself and the people living in the earth system, are groaning underneath this fallen state of affairs. We call it entropy in the scientific world. It's the idea that there's less and less energy with which to do work. Everything is going downhill over time. And so you have to work hard in order to get anywhere living in this world. And so he says, that's a tough row to hoe. And I look at it and I can see that it's out of control. It's vanity. It's chasing after wind. It's like trying to grab the wind and put it in a box and save it for later and make it do what you want. That's life. It really needs to just be lived as it happens. Verse 15, what is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be counted. Once something is crooked, getting it straight again takes way too much energy. And more than likely, you're not going to get it done. If you don't believe me, try to straighten a paper clip into its perfect straight form before at the factory it was manipulated into the paperclip form. You're not going to get it done. And try this. Try to account for all of the things that you can't count. You can't be done because you don't know the total of everything in that topic. Can you come up with what atoms in the universe you can't see? Well, since you don't know what the total number is, and you really don't even, you're not even capable of counting the number of the atoms that you can see, you can't put a number on the ones you haven't seen yet. You just can't do it. It's a philosophical fallacy. You cannot count that which is uncountable. Verse 16, I said to my heart, or in my heart, making my choices, I have acquired great wisdom and surpassed all who were in Jerusalem before me. Now again, that I think is much easier to apply to Hezekiah, who is many, 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 many kings down the line from David, who was the first Jewish king to rule at Jerusalem, than it is to apply to Solomon, who was only the second king to rule at Jerusalem as an Israeli. Now, there were kings previous to David, and I suppose it could be applied to that, but still, even with that count, Hezekiah has more. It says, I've acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. Now, that's true of Solomon, yes, but you remember that it's also true of Hezekiah. And in fact, Hezekiah doesn't just simply have the collection of Solomon's wisdom. He's also got additional bits of wisdom that he's added into the book of Proverbs, and wisdom even of his own. Verse 17, I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. Now, madness and folly are the ideas of just craziness and silliness and things that drive you crazy. Puzzles would be one of the ways to talk about this madness here. The folly is the silliness idea. So he says, I've tried to open my mind to all the different ways to think about life. Wisdom, puzzles, and silliness. And I perceived that this also is but a striving after wind. So it's still out of control, even when you try to apply those ways to understanding it. For, verse 18, in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Now, what does he mean by this? We have a saying, the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. And sometimes that'll get you frustrated, vexation here. That'll get you irritated with the fact that there's just so much more you can't get your mind wrapped around. And not just that. The more you know, the more you wish you didn't know. Because sometimes once you learn something, it's like just a weight, a burden upon you. We say, there are certain things that you can't unsee that you wish you could. Well, similarly, there are many things that we probably wish we could unlearn, but it's too late. We've already got it in there. And that's why we sometimes get very sad the more we know. And we're also held accountable for what we know. And that is also burdensome upon us. So wisdom is good, and he will say that several times through here. Wisdom is what we need, but with it comes reality. And that reality is sometimes a difficult burden to carry. Chapter number 2. I said in my heart, come now, I'm going to test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. Now, he's not talking about wild hedonism here, where you just take all the restraints off. He'll make that very clear in a little bit. He's saying, I decided I would just try to be happy. Just enjoy life totally as it happens. But, he says at the end of that verse, behold, this also was vanity, meaning it was still out of control. I said of laughter, it's mad. And of pleasure, well, what use is it? So laughter is sometimes the best medicine. We know that. And the Proverbs have had something similar to say along that line. But if that's all you ever do is just laugh about stuff, that's crazy. That itself is not going to get things done that need to get done. So that's madness. And if you're only focused on physical pleasure, what good does that do you? That will promote, as the Proverbs talked against, laziness and selfishness if you only care about pleasuring your own physical form. Verse 3. I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine. My heart's still guiding me with wisdom. Notice that. He says, I decided to be a wine connoisseur. And we know people in history that's how they try to enjoy life, is they try to collect all these different vintages and enjoy the different flavors and smells and the look of these vintages of wine. And he says, I tried that. And I tried to do it with wisdom keeping me leveled. So he's not talking about getting drunk here. He's talking about just enjoying vintages. And how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of his or their life. So I did this to try to just relax, take my mind off of dying and all of that. But that wasn't the only thing he did. He wasn't just simply a wine connoisseur. Listen to what else he did. I made great works. I built houses, you know, pleasant places to live in, to visit, and planted vineyards for myself. That's going to be tied in with having the vintages. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. So he's got places where it's just nice to walk or sit or lay down to see the sights, smell the smells, taste the tastes. I made myself pools from which to water the forests of growing trees. So I did all that was necessary to keep this up. And I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. Now, these might be servants that he's hired, and then servants that are growing up in his service. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who were before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women. So he has all these servants, and they're singing songs and doing wonderful things for him. He's got all the money. He's got all the things. He also has one last thing that we're going to run out of time today, and I need to come back to this and explain a little bit better tomorrow. But the text in the English Standard Version says, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man. I think we can have a better English translation of that.